When you try to restore a wandering sheep who doesn't particularly want to be restored, the conversation will probably not go very long until Matthew chapter 7 is brought up. Judge not, that you be not judged. 30 years ago, it was said that the biblical anthem on college campuses was John 3:16. You could hardly watch a sporting event without somebody with orange, green, or blue hair sporting a sign that said John 3:16. You don't see that as much anymore, and I think it has to do with postmodernism, which has probably replaced Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, as the anthem. Judge not, lest you be judged. My assignment is a little different than maybe the topic would directly indicate, although it certainly comes from Matthew 7, so let me read what I was given. Often in our dealings with friends, family members, co-workers, etc., we come across individuals leading lives contrary to the will of God. Sometimes they have no desire to seek God, but at other times they profess discipleship but live otherwise. Others demand and expect acceptance of their lifestyles even when it's contrary to God's will. How do we address sin in others without coming across as judgmental and condescending? Should our approach be different with one who has fallen away versus one who has never known the Lord? And I was given 4 or 5 passages that I'll be using, but you can guess what they were, so I'll just unfold them as I get to them. Each one of us have either a family member, a friend, a co-worker, or an acquaintance who is not living according to God's will. That's simply a fact. Sharing the gospel or restoring them is difficult. That's a fact. And it becomes more difficult when it involves someone with whom we are close to or have frequent contact with. But it also does not change the fact that I believe we are commanded to share the gospel, and there is no excuse for not doing so. Be ready always to give an answer. Go. Preach. So now what? How do we share? How do we bring them back? These wandering sheep, our family members, our friends, our co-workers, our acquaintances. Jesus said in Mark 16:15, "Go you into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature." Well, we read those words. We start out to follow them. And who do we see standing right in front of us? Our families, our friends, our co-workers. People that we are close to. Oh, why couldn't it be a group of strangers that I'll never see again in case this doesn't go well? But the most difficult group to confront are those that we encounter the most. Why is that? Well, I think probably fear has a lot to do with it. Because with strangers, we see little to lose. So what if they never speak to us again? They haven't been speaking to me anyway. But with someone that we have contact with, we've got something to lose. A close friend, a brother. There we've got a risk. A risk of shunning. A risk of a changed relationship. No wonder Jesus said, "I come to bring a sword," and set man against father and daughter against mother. Some of you know the ramifications of that scripture far more personally than I do. But who of us cannot share Paul's feelings from Romans chapter 10, verse 1? "My heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved." Who of us wants family to not be saved? Who of us can't share in our own sphere Christ weeping over the city of Jerusalem? The ones that maybe he loved the most, if we could categorize his degrees of love, and the ones he was seemingly, at that moment, most helpless to help. UCLA sociologist James Wilson observed an interesting fact about urban life. I quote, "The crime rate escalates on those streets where broken windows are not repaired. Failure to replace broken windows makes an announcement to the public that the standards have been lowered and authority abandoned. Wilson saw such practices of disrepair as an invitation for further crime within without the threat, of adverse consequences." End quote. Well, I believe what's true about city streets is also true about Christian life. If we allow sin and rebellion to go unchecked in our lives or in the lives of those we love, we invite destruction in those lives. When we exercise, when we use, when we allow godly instruction to stop, repair, and change damaging behavior, we erect a fence of protection that will at least discourage further erosion. A process that should never be enjoyable, fun, but I believe a process that love demands. It is an essentialness, and I believe that's why we're giving a passage such as Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. "Ye which are spiritual, restore one another in the spirit of meekness." Now, be careful and consider yourself, lest you also be lost. And it's the pain of that I believe is the reason we're given Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1 that cautions us, "Judge not that you be not judged." In the last 30 years, I think there has been a dramatic increase of three attitudes that have become prevalent in our society. They have, in my opinion, become the gods, small g, of our society. Three mindsets: open-mindedness, total acceptance, and privacy. I believe those are the social moorings of our society. They're not the social moorings of the church, but thankfully the church is not our society. First of all, open-mindedness. I believe it's considered the highest of all character qualities in our society. And it is good in the sense of what it used to mean, willing to consider other points of view. But today, open-mindedness really doesn't mean that. When somebody says they want you or they are open-minded, it usually is alluding to the fact that they believe there is no such thing as absolute truth. What's true for one may not be true for another. Truth is relative to circumstances. Truth is constantly changing. That kind of open-mindedness we have to reject. If I take two cats and tie their tails together and put them on the table in front of me, they are unified. There is no unity, because you can't take polar opposites. Sadly, this mindset can creep into our lives and into our minds. So much that for all practical purposes, the concept of discipline and restoring has not only left our society, it has left many congregations and many relationships. The concept of total acceptance. We are encouraged, demanded to accept the behavior of those around us. The cry is tolerance. The price of intolerance is to be called ignorant or even a bigot. Don't judge me. You have no right to judge me. We can see the flaws in that thinking, but it can and has crept into life after life. Many church members today, I believe, view church membership as a right, and I don't believe that is true. You and I do not have the right to be members of the Lord's kingdom. We have the privilege of being members of the Lord's kingdom. And with that privilege comes responsibility and accountability. Just as parents are expected to exercise guidance over their children, God commands, He doesn't suggest, He commands that we do that one to another. That as the local congregations, as brothers and sisters, we have accountability to one another. We're to watch over one another. One reason I believe that restoring and correction has often gone to the wayside is that we've become afraid of being labeled as judgmental. Number three, privacy. Stay out of my life. It's none of your business. It's private. You may or may not believe it, but there is probably nobody here that is more private than I am. In America, privacy has been elevated to constitutional status. Many current issues hide behind privacy. Abortion, sexual orientation, ethical moorings, nobody's business. The issue of privacy can invade the home, the church, our lives. It could invade the relationship between kids and parents. You have no right to invade my privacy. Stay out of my room. Well, parents, I believe you've got every right, and I'm going to go further. I believe you have every responsibility to be in their business. Heard of a family once that was having trouble with their teenager, and the problem they were having is that whenever something would come up and they would have to discipline or have a discussion with the teenager, they would run into their bedroom and lock the door. And the dad said, "I don't know what we can do." Well, I never faced that particular dilemma, but I can tell you what I'd do. The next time that child came home from school, there would be no door. Now, I respect privacy, and I'm all for doors. But I'm not for them being used to hide behind. I was watching a news show this morning before we came to church. I won't say who it was, but it was someone that had a drug problem and apparently had been clean for several years. And they asked this man, "What drugs were you on?" He said, "It doesn't matter." He said, "That's like asking me what color my sneakers are. It doesn't matter because they're all used to run away. And whatever you use to run away, it doesn't matter what you use. The problem is the running away." The idea of privacy can invade our relationships. Churches sometimes becoming thermometers that reflect the temperature of the environment rather than thermostats who set the temperature of the environment. Now we go to Galatians chapter 6, which you would have expected. I make no apologies for it. I'm glad the program committee suggested it. "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." In the spiritual war that we are fighting, there will always be casualties. Duane said, there are always going to be wandering sheep, and if honesty prevails, we've all at one point in our lives or points in our lives been those wandering sheep. Amen. Satan's fiery darts sometimes pierce a brother's, a sister's, or our armor. Lying, adultery, neglect, broken homes, spiritual apathy, premarital sex, cursing, etc., they occur. Christians sometimes fall into sin. It's an inescapable fact. Temptation is like a flash flood, a tornado, that can sweep a believer off his feet just as quickly as some of the people were swept off their feet in Joplin, without any hardly warning. When it happens, what do we do? Well, I thought the Amplified did a kind of a nice job. It certainly embellished Galatians 6, 1 and 2, but I'd just like to read the emphasis they placed there. "Brethren, if anyone is overtaken in misconduct or sin of any sort, you which are spiritual, you which are responsive to and controlled by the Spirit, should set him right and restore and reinstate him without any sense of superiority, and with all gentleness, keeping an attentive eye on yourselves, lest you fall into temptation also. Bear, endure, and carry one another's burdens and moral faults, and in this way fulfill and observe perfectly the law of Christ, and complete what was lacking in your obedience to it. King James says, ye which are spiritual. This embellishes that those of you who are responsive to and controlled by the Spirit. Now, who here doesn't want to be in that category? To the Corinthians, Paul wrote, but all things are from God, who through Jesus Christ reconciled to himself and gave to us, and this is the phrase I love, the ministry of reconciliation. You and I are to be reconcilers. We're to be in the ministry of reconciliation, that by word and deed you might bring others into harmony with him. 2 Corinthians 5:18. What a wonderful thought. The ministry of reconciliation. I believe that's a command laid at each of our feet. A demanding responsibility, a touchy task, because it's often with people we are closest to. Will they get mad at us? Should I ignore it? Should I let somebody else do it? Somebody better? Well, is it any of my business anyway? Often because of fear, trepidation, slothfulness, we sidestep the command, we bypass the task with cop-outs. Then on the infrequent times we do address the task, our arrogance, our sense of superiority often ruins the result, as it is devoid of the meekness that Paul talked to us about in Galatians 6:1. More on that in a moment. Hindrances to our ministry of reconciliation. One of them, I think, is timidness, lack of confidence, not knowing our brothers and sisters well enough. Well, maybe time will fix it, and I shouldn't really do anything. Or if I wait long enough, maybe someone more qualified will step in. We don't want to be thought of as busybodies. Now, I think we sometimes want to be busybodies, but we don't want to be thought of as busybodies. All of these can simply become excuses. Moses was reluctant and timid, but what he accomplished when he let God take charge. Timidness, correctly infused with faith in God, is what produces productive humility. Sometimes boldness can be a problem. I wrote down initially in my notes, we don't want to be known as bulls in the china shop. I scratched that out. Most of us don't want to be known as bulls in the china shop, but I know some people that I think just want to be and enjoy being a bull in a china shop. And the more they come in and swag each way and break dishes, the more they feel they've accomplished. Well, sometimes it is necessary to be blunt. Woe unto the Pharisees is a litany of bluntness. He didn't mince any words. When Paul was writing to Philemon to take Onesimus back, I think that took a lot of courage. Paul didn't know how that was going to be taken. It seemingly maybe was taken as Paul intended it, but Paul didn't know that when he wrote those words and sent the letter off. Sometimes, and it's been mentioned several times already, apathy. Well, they know there's nothing else I can tell them. I know they won't listen to me. I'll probably just make things worse. Well, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but I don't think that alleviates you and I of the responsibility and the commandment to try. Jonah took apathy to a new low. There are times when these thoughts may be true, but they should never lie in our hearts as excuses for not restoring such a one in the spirit of meekness. I I was asked to talk about, and this phrase wasn't used in the note I got, but I've called it the arrogant rebuker. I believe one of the sad ironies of reconciliation ministry is that it is often the arrogant who are most inclined to do it. And that's a real dilemma. That's a dilemma. Now, why would the arrogant be most inclined to do it? Because they have confidence. It may be misguided, probably is over-evaluated, but they feel they are right. So they're going to be the ones most inclined to do it, and the ones sometimes least inclined to do it with meekness, gentleness, and love. Correction does take courage. You know, I believe arrogance is a flaw that all of us struggle with, to varying degrees. I like C.S. Lewis's words. There is someone I love, even though I don't approve of what he does. There is someone I accept, though some of his thoughts and actions revolt me. There is someone I forgive, though he hurts the people I love the most. That person is me. So how do we avoid coming across arrogant or condescending? Well, the simple answer is don't be arrogant and don't be condescending. But that doesn't give us much more guidance than we had, does it? Now, I want to be clear. I do not believe being forceful is always being arrogant. I don't think Christ was arrogant. I don't think the apostles were arrogant in many of the times when they were forceful. And it is not arrogant to proclaim the rightness of truth. That's our job. But Galatians 6:1 gives us a key. With all meekness. In any field, be it sports, arts, your profession, or spiritual growth, there are always some people who are further along in their development than others. That's true in the church. It's true in the workplace. We live in a society where trash-talking athletes and egomaniacal business tycoons are idolized. Eventually, there will be people that feel the need to tell and show you how much better they are than you. They may not do it with words, but they can do it with actions. They can do it with attitudes. And that, I believe, is what I would call spiritual arrogance. Often rooted in inferiority feelings, paranoia, and lack of confidence. It has been my experience that many times those of us who externally appear arrogant are sometimes the most insecure. We feel the most challenged, displaying how advanced maybe they are compared to you. When this happens, a difference of opinion is often felt as an attack upon their mastery. I spent several years dealing with individuals that I think I just described. None of them here. And that kind of behavior has a couple of major drawbacks. It inhibits our own development. When you already know everything, there's no room for additional wisdom, and there's no perceived need of additional wisdom. But always remember, a wise man can learn from a fool, but a fool will never learn from a wise man. Secondly, these attitudes can repel the one that you or I might be striving to reach. How do you want to be restored? By an arrogant know-it-all? No. By someone that really cares about you. We're all like that. In Luke chapter 18, Jesus is giving a parable. I'm not really interested in the parable, although obviously it's a wonderful parable, but I'm interested in what is said about his audience in verse 9 of Luke 18. And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves. Now, how would you, in one word, describe people who trust in themselves? Well, you guessed what I'm going to say. Arrogant. Socially, arrogance is the mentality which follows from the belief that one is better than those around him. However, religiously and spiritually, arrogance goes deeper. Religious arrogance says that you know the mind of God better than the person you're talking to. It's a mentality that feels God agrees with us rather than us agreeing with God. It's the fear of vulnerability. I think that's one of the things that makes achieving Galatians 6:1 difficult for many of us. Maybe virtually impossible. Because restoration cannot be submission to the restorer. It has to be submission to God. We can get people to submit to the restorer, but if that restorer is not God, what have we got? We've got nothing. I believe it was the arrogant restoration that caused Jesus to condemn having a judgmental. I think in Matthew 7, sometimes we call that hypocritical judgment, and there is an element there, but it's the arrogant judgment. And that is not the righteous judgment that he talks to us about in John 7:24, is it? Well, what are some of the cures maybe that would help us be more effective? Well, it's doubtful that God can really use any of us until we've been crushed in the crucible of life. And I can honestly tell you, I wish I didn't believe that was true. Because being crushed in the crucible of life hurts. And it doesn't feel good. And I don't wish it for any of us, but it does happen. I remember a passage here in Luke 22. Jesus is talking to Peter. Verses 31 and 32. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I pray for you that your faith fail not, and when you are restored or returned or converted, you will strengthen your brethren. Now, what's he saying to Peter? He's saying, Satan's wanting to get you. I hope it doesn't ruin you. But I pray that you're going to come out of these tests better able to help others. I hope every marriage here lasts until you die. But if you've gone through a divorce and are still striving to walk with the Lord, think how you can help others in ways that some of the rest of us can't. I wish nobody ever had problems with drugs and alcohol. But think how someone who has gone through that can then minister to someone who's struggling with it in ways that some of the rest of us can't. Being beaten down and falling are not goals for the Christian. But they can be lessons to help us learn to lean on the Lord and not other people. I remember I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I won't get any more specific other than to mention one name. There was two evangelists in our kitchen back in Martinsville, Indiana. One of them was my dad. The other one was Richard Regans. I was 10 or 12, and if I was sat there real quiet, they would forget I was there so I could listen. And they forgot I was there. They were talking about a young person that one of them had been working with to maybe become an evangelist. I never will forget what Richard said. He said, I think he'll be a good man if we can get the arrogance out of him. I don't know whether that worked or not, but I've always remembered that. And it is such a struggle for me. I think one of the cures that can help us, and I'm now talking to myself. If you want to listen, that's fine. No, I mean that. Trying to place ourselves in the other person's shoes. How would I like to be confronted? What would work best if you were going to try to help me? Knowing our subject. In Romans chapter 12, verse 16, the subject here is not restoring Christians, it's dealing with our enemies. But there's a verse that I think has a wonderful thought that I'd like to capture. In Romans 12, 16, he says, "Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men in low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits." Be of one mind. Well, that could mean have the mind of Christ, and I wouldn't argue with that. But I also think that can have the idea of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. What would it be like if you had gone through what they'd gone through? Maybe that will help us not be so arrogant in our approach. The King James says, "Condescend to members of low estate." Adjust, I think is the thought there. Adjust to them. Each case is different. Adjust to whom you're with. Some people you need to be firm with. Other people you need to be compassionate. Some people you need to talk to. Other people you need to listen to. And be not wise in your own conceits. Thirdly, maybe it will help us if we would realize who we are and who we aren't. Do you feel like you're God's gift to the brotherhood? Well, I think we ought to feel that there's only been one real gift, and that's the Lord Jesus Christ. Arrogancy can cause people to become Laodiceans so that they'll want to spit us out of their mouth. Paul says, "Do it in meekness." Oh, that's hard. In a congregation that's not here, I mean, it has members who are here, but they won't know this. But it's not this congregation. That's what I'm trying to say. Three young men, maybe 10 years ago, in their mid-20s, met in the back room of that building after services. One of those young men had observed two of the other young men in conduct that was not Christian. And he told me later he struggled and he prayed about what to do. He knew the easy thing, let the elders take care of it. But his conscience wouldn't let him, so he asked the other two young men to go in. They closed the door. One of the other two young men also told me that the meeting started by this one young man crying. And then he told them what concerned him about their conduct. One of those two young men is still with the church. The other left. But at least one was pulled from the fire. But what I really liked about that true illustration was the meekness and the gentleness with which this wise younger brother in the Lord and his courage. Solomon writes in Proverbs 25:12, "As an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon the obedient ear." Now, I've been talking as if we're the ones that need to do the reproving of someone who's fallen away. But I want us all to understand that probably as many times as not, we're the ones that need to be reproved. And if you have somebody who loves you enough to tell you the truth, you're rich. and don't cast them away. Because there are so few people, even in the church, that will do that for you. You are blessed. I think in general, you do a good job with this. I also think it's one of the most difficult tasks that God has given us. We need to be very sensitive of one another's feelings. But let's never put feelings ahead of souls. Because that's not love. We're going to close our thoughts. We're going to extend the gospel invitation. Terry has selected a number. If you've fallen away, if you've never accepted the Lord, we don't know what's in your heart. I know the brethren here would be more than happy and eager and joyous to assist you in whatever need you might have. So we invite you to consider that and come forward if it's appropriate as we stand and as we sing.